Okay, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. And so I'm going to continue on talking about some AGN studies that we recently are conducting using X-ray observatories and some ground-based observatories. People are getting more and more interested in black holes thanks to some recent films like Interstellar. I teach a black hole class, and one year it was overfilled by students because they had watched the movie. So this is kind of one of the images from his book, where you can see that due to the strong lensing, you can see the bending of the top side of the back part of the accretion disk, and this is the bending of light from the bottom side of the back side of the accretion disk, and then you can see the beaming effect on the left-hand side. So these are my collaborators for the Iron Line Microlensing Project. There are additional collaborators that have contributed to the microlensing project overall, but these are the ones that have worked on the Iron Line Microlensing Project. So just to give you an outline, overview, give a brief overview of the different accretion regimes and a little bit discussion of the corona of AGN, how we use microlensing to constrain the sizes of the accretion disk and the corona of AGN, a little bit about a monitoring project, and this new technique of microlensing the iron line emission that's coming from the accretion disk. And again, back to things that we discussed previously. Here we're using the accretion disk as a tool to study strong gravity. So I'll try to, we do discover some features of the accretion disk, like how far in does it go and so forth. So I'll try to focus on those points as well. But essentially, this is a good test bed to study GR at the strong limit. And so I'll present how we can actually constrain things like the inclination angle, the ISCO, and the spin of distant quasars. So as we've heard in previous talks, there are three main accretion regimes, and depending on your accretion mass accretion rate, you could be either in the radiative inefficient regime, or in most of the quasars that I'll be talking about, we think we're in the thin disk regime, so accretion rates less than L. Eddington, and obviously we heard also if you're above that, the disk turns into, you have a slim disk. So, and it's nice to see from the simulations now that you can actually reproduce this high temperature corona that's above and below the black hole, shown on the right here, temperatures of more than 100 KV, and in the thin disk regime, you can see that what accretion rates you need to create a thin disk like that. So the fiducial model that I'll be using and having in my mind, and it's probably just maybe some approximations, but this is the idea that I'll have in my mind, is you have an accretion disk with a corona above and below. You have UV photons from the disk that actually get upscattered. One of these is the pen. All right. So UV photons get upscattered and produce the X-rays, and that's what I would call the direct X-rays. And then you get a reflection from X-rays that impinge on the disk. Ones that fall very close to the black hole will be relativistically blurred, whereas ones that are that reflected further out will not be relativistically blurred. And all these components have to be taken into account when you do the modeling of X-ray spectra. All right, so this accretion disk tomography, what we are trying to do is measure the sizes of the optical and UV regions of AGN and compare our measurements with that of thin disk theory. And using now, and I'll focus on this new technique of using shifts of the iron line, and these shifts are due to general relativistic effects. When you're very emission coming very close to the black hole, you'll actually see the relativistic Doppler effects and GR effects. And that will allow us to place constraints on the innermost stable circular orbit. Also from the microlensing, we also place constraints on the corona size, which is very important for people who want to model the structure. All right, so I'll give you a brief introduction of microlensing. So here's the observer, here's this quasar, and if you have an alignment of some large gravitational potential produced by a galaxy, light from this quasar will reach us on multiple paths. So you will actually see multiple images. That's called strong lensing. And there are time delays associated with these different paths that could vary from minutes up to years in some systems. For microlensing, you actually have light rays that get slightly deflected by stars in the lensing galaxy. These deflections are very small, so that's why we call this microlensing. But they result in a magnification of the quasar, the distant quasar, but also they essentially produce this magnification pattern on the accretion disk. And this magnification pattern actually moves across the accretion disk because essentially observer, galaxy, and quasar are moving, so there's a net velocity with which these caustics cross. So you can just imagine a magnifying glass going across the accretion disk and magnifying a certain section of it. That's essentially what we hope to be observing to essentially scan the accretion disk. The important aspect of microlensing is it depends on the size. So regions that are very large will be less affected by microlensing, and regions that are very small, like the X-ray region, will be more affected by microlensing. This is one of the quasars where microlensing was first established and discovered. This is the famous Einstein cross. You can see the four lens images of the quasar. You can actually see the lensing galaxy. This is a case where the lensing galaxy is very close by, and you can actually see this is the core of the galaxy. On the right, you see the brightnesses of these four images, and you can see that there's obviously a lot of variability. So part of that variability is intrinsic to the quasar, and that's the correlated part of the variability. The uncorrelated part is due to microlensing. So this is the first nice case of the proof that microlensing is detectable in quasars. So we actually developed this complicated model. Actually, this was first developed by Chris Kochanek, how to model the microlensing in these quasars. Essentially, you assume some size scale for the emission structure. You assume some mass scale for the stars in the lensing galaxy, some local surface density, some velocity vector for the caustic motion, and you produce millions of randomized star fields, and then you move these magnification caustics across the accretion disk, produce a light curve, and then fit that to your data, and then you'll see, oh, it's not a good fit, so you do this process for millions of times until you get a good chi-square, and then you say, okay, this then gives us the size of the, which is the free parameter of the emission region, but you also can learn something about the dark matter component of the lensing galaxy and the sizes of the stars. So these are typical magnification patterns, and here, to give you a comparison, this is the size of the emission region, X-ray emission region versus the optical emitting region, and you can see that the X-ray region is much smaller than the typical caustic size. So that's why those regions, the X-rays, will be significantly magnified compared to the optical region. So this is a magnification caustics for one of the quasars that I'll talk about, and this is for the Einstein cross. All right, so this is the objects that we're currently monitoring. both in with the Chandra X-ray Observatory that has a spatial resolution to resolve the images. So these are the redshifts of the sources and the redshifts of the lenses. So in monitoring, as I said, by Chandra, and you don't really need a large telescope to do the optical monitoring. All right, so just to show you, we also have some of these were monitored with Hubble to get constraints on the UV sizes of the accretion disks. This is, again, RXC-1131. You can see the lensing galaxy here. You can see the four images. This is a double here. And sometimes you can actually see some arcs which are due to the stretching of the host galaxy. All right, so this is a few snapshots from the X-ray observations of RXC-1131. Just looking at these observations, you can see just by eye that there's a lot of variability going on in the X-ray from one epoch to the other, all right? And we've been monitoring this object for about 10 years now, and we have some very interesting data now to show. All right, so we talked about constraints that microlensing has placed on the accretion disk, and this is the major result. This was published in 2010 by Chris Morgan. And you can see here points with the error bars are from the microlensing results. For a large range of black holes, you can see the black hole mass versus the inferred radius at 2,500 angstroms. And the solid line is the fit to the microlensing data, and the dashed line is from thin disk theory. And you can see there's a roughly an offset of factor of 3, so the microlensing inferred size of the optical region is larger. The scaling is roughly the same with respect to mass, it's two-thirds here, but obviously there's this offset which, as was mentioned, was confirmed independently with reverberation mapping for nearby SAFET. So this is, applies to quasars, but this discrepancy that people have provided some interpretations today, it seems to be real. All right, now, as I mentioned, most of the X-rays in quasars come from the direct component from the corona. So essentially, we're constraining the size of the X-ray corona. And before these measurements, people had these ideas that maybe the corona is just these coronal loops over the disk and extends way out. And I think this kind of like settles that issue that the corona is not really this extended thing that goes way out. It's pretty compact, less than 10 RG. So I think this is a very significant result regarding constraining models that try to, that use the lamppost model. And these results have actually been also confirmed with these time lag measurements where people can measure the size of the corona, and they also agree that the corona is actually very compact. And again, this is over a range of black hole masses, and you can see the corona is actually really, really tight. All right, so this is the object I want to focus on in the rest of the talk, RXJ1131. These are the X-ray light curves of the four images. And as I said, part of the variability is due to intrinsic variability, and part is due to microlensing. Yeah, so actually these are the time delays right here. So these curves have actually been shifted with respect to the known time delays. So D is the one, as actually you notice, has a very large time delay. The other ones are within a day. All right, so what was very interesting was when we looked at, we have about 40 observations of this object with Chandra. And when you look at 40 times 4 spectra, you see this emission line. This is where the ion K alpha line. So this is a line that we know that exists from fluorescence from the accretion disk and should be at about 6.4 keV. Sometimes it's slightly higher if the disk is ionized, but we think this accretion disk in particular is not. We don't think it's highly ionized. But so this. So we see a line. In this case, this one is slightly redshifted. All right, so this is in image D. I'll show you. So one important thing for any observer is to show the significance of a line, to show it's real, right? Any detection. So in addition to doing the chi-square confidence contours, we also did a Monte Carlo simulation to prove that to high confidence level, this line is actually very significant. All right, so this is now the line you can see actually is even more redshifted here to 4.5 kV in a different image. And again, when you look at the other images, the line is not there. So it's a microlensing event, and it only occurs in one image at a time. And sometimes we see two emission lines, and these are significantly redshifted. And this is an image C, and you see, again, two lines. Just to see, well, what happens, these spectra a composition of both the unlensed and microlensed spectrum. So you'd think that, well, where is the unlensed 6.4 kV? If you just throw out all the microlensing events and stack the spectra where you have no microlensing events, you do actually recover the 6.4 kV line, all right? So it means that there is a unlensed line and the disk is performing as expected and with the expected equivalent width that typically is found in unlensed quasars. All right, so the next step is to do something very simple, is to calculate the shifts of a line due to GR effects and Doppler, special relativistic Doppler effects. So you can determine very straightforward this generalized Doppler shift. The one component is from special relativity, and this component is from GR. And obviously, the Doppler component will depend on, you know, how close you are to the event horizon, your azimuthal velocity here, and also depend on the angle between the motion of the material and your line of sight. And this part will depend on all these terms that you can get for a standard curved black hole geometry. All right, so what is this G distribution method? Well, you take all those shifts that we've observed over these 10 years, and you just produce a histogram of those shifts. And what you find is that this histogram is truncated on both sides very abruptly. There's very strong cutoffs. And so, one interpretation is the strong cutoffs on the low side must be related to, well, you can't get any closer to the black hole. There must be some boundary, and that's probably very close to the ISCO. And on the high redshifts, on the high energy side, you must have a cutoff that's due to the fact that, you know, you have an extreme Doppler shifting, and that is very sensitive to the inclination angle of the disk. All right, so before I continue, I wanted to mention that there are a lot of reasons, determining the spin of a black hole is a very important issue, because you can learn about the history of how the black hole, like, you know, the spin will depend upon how many mergers the AGN went through, or if there was chaotic or coherent accretion. So a lot of people are interested eventually in determining the spin distribution as a function of redshift to learn something about the evolution of galaxies. So people have used this traditional technique, and there are other people in the audience like Chris Reynolds who are more experts in this technique and have applied it to many SAFERTs. And essentially what happens, if you take two annuli here, you can see you can get the iron line, the Doppler horns for emission coming towards you and away from you. This is for two annuli. And because of beaming, the blue component obviously is stronger. And because of GR effects, both annuli are redshifted. And then if you integrate over the entire disk, you get this distorted line, which then you fit to your data and you can infer the spin. So this technique has been applied to 20 or so nearby SAFERTs. And this is mostly from work done by Chris Reynolds. And you see on the right, this is the distribution of spin parameters we have as a function of black hole mass. I must say that people sometimes worry that a lot of these spin values are very high, like, and these are SAFERT galaxies that are radio quiet. So people, you know, are a little bit skeptical, but also there's a selection effect that objects that have a high spin are more luminous, so this is a detection bias as well. But you see, this is how to model, to get the spin of a black hole is very tricky. You need a spectrum with a very high signal to noise, because you have to include the direct component, the blurred relativistic component, and this distant reflection. And sometimes you need like the high energy data to constrain such models. So it's very difficult. You need really, really, and you cannot apply this to quasars because they're just too faint. All right. So as I said, there are issues, and this could be a selection bias. So in the technique, this G distribution technique that I'm proposing, you can apply, you can try attempt to measure the spin and the ISCO radius in quasars now by looking at this distribution of shifts. And the four objects that I'm presenting, this is the L Bull over L Eddington, so we think we're in the thin disk regime. And here I show the velocity of these caustics as they go across the accretion disk, and this is how long we think it takes for a caustic to go across the source.
How do you know that transverse velocity?
It's very complicated. So you have to make some assumptions. You take the CMB velocity in that direction and take into account the redshift of both source. And the lens, so it's not trivial. But Chris Kuchanek's team has actually done that for all the quasars that we know. So again, there's an uncertainty in here, but essentially this doesn't play that much role in this technique. It's more, we actually can measure this directly when we see a microlensing event. We can see actually how long it actually takes to go across. So we can actually constrain some of these models from the data as well. All right, so this is the distribution for RXC 1131. So this is the distribution of shifts. So 6.4 kV is where the line should be, and you can see that you have the sharp cutoff just below 4 kV, and you have a sharp cutoff here at about 8 and something kV. So we can start off with a simple model of this G factor and plot this G factor as a function of distance from the black hole. And these horizontal lines here represent the extremes that I showed. So I will leave it there and open to any questions that you have. Thank you.
On, but I don't. Oh, here we are. Okay. In addition to the inclination, it seems to me there's another important angle, which is the angle that the transverse velocity makes with respect to the line of nodes or something.
Yes.
And that varies somewhat due to motions of stars within the lensing galaxy. Mm-hmm. If the bulk motion of the galaxy or our motion dominates. Mm-hmm. Can you dig that out somehow?
So essentially you're right that the actual shift will depend on we call it a caustic crossing angle, right? Which will be different obviously from one image to the other and from one caustic crossing to the other. And that actually is part of an input into the simulations where we look at simulate all possible crossing angles. But in the end of the day, what we really care about is this distribution that we get for, you know, of these shifts. No matter how they were produced, you'll get these two boundaries. But you're correct. If you want to then compare the data, the actual shape of the distribution to the observed distribution to the simulated one, you have to make an assumption about the caustic crossing angle as well.
So I had a couple quick questions, I think. So yeah. One is, in both of the cases you've measured so far well,
yes,
the inclinations come out around 80 degrees.
Yes.
So shouldn't these be type 2 quasars? Yeah.
In two of those cases, you're right, they're high inclination, and that's the only way we can get those high blue shifts. In one of the cases, which I didn't mention, which I recently was puzzled by, is why in the Einstein cross, we don't get any blue shifted component. So I digged up a paper by Poindexter et al. With Chris Kochanek way back, where they use what's called dynamic microlensing, and they actually were able to constrain the inclination angle of this object, and this object is almost face on. So this actually will be consistent that we're not seeing blue shifted components. So this one actually would be a
right,
small inclination
I sort
angle.
Of mean more the other way around in the sense
so these
that
ones here
but that they those go against unification models basically.
Well, these are quasars, so I think you can still in a quasar, the idea is in quasars maybe the torus is not as big, so you can be
I think it's more than 10 degrees.
So again, like for example, Bal quasars, we think that are high inclination angle as well.
Can I comment on that? I don't think that's true. You can learn about the covering factor of the torus from the IR excess, and it's just as large in the high luminosity ones. I just did an exercise with Frederick Moran. We looked at the high Z 3C quasars because there's no host contamination and because every narrowline radio galaxy there has a hidden quasar. It's a perfect pristine sample to work with. Mm-hmm. And the radio core dominance of every quasar is greater than the radio core dominance of every radio galaxy. In other words, there's no room for high inclination quasars or holes in the torus.
All right, well, again, I mean, this is what, in order to get these very high blue shifted lines, this is what this implies. And again, you have quasars we know of that, like broad absorption line quasars where we think you're looking at them at high inclination angle, and these, again, time will show.
Sort of a related question, I guess, because of this is, perhaps the most interesting and controversial thing to come out of the thing prior to this was the size discrepancy. So I've always wondered, I mean, as you've pointed out, the modeling that goes into this is extremely complex, and you have other parameters than just, let's say, the size of the emitting region. So I don't know enough about this, but I always worry about systematic effects to do with parameter correlations. So, how confident, having done this kind of stuff, are you that the numbers you're getting are reliable? I mean, I know you plot the sort of statistical errors on there, but are there systematic errors that you worry about that might screw you up?
One thing is that you're right. There could be some systematic errors creeping up, but it's nice to see that we see a correlation of the sizes with black hole mass. So that comes out. So we're doing something right, and the fact that we're independently getting similar results from a completely independent technique, I think, is very powerful in any detection of any kind. You want a completely independent technique to confirm your results. So the numbers we are getting for the average sizes of the stars seems reasonable, and so the best fit parameters seem to make sense. And also we get constraints not only for the optical sizes but the corona, which also agree with, as I mentioned, so both the optical and UV sizes. And one thing I forget to mention is the UV sizes. We have constraints, and the UV size actually seem to be pretty large compared to the corona size. And this to me is an issue regarding launching winds. So a lot of these outflows we detect with very high velocities, they have to be launched very close into the black hole, and sometimes they're actually closer in from what you expect the UV region to be. And then you think, well, how can you then drive them with UV radiation alone? So my idea is that you have to consider both components, and maybe initially the wind is driven mostly by magnetic pressure when you're launching it very close to the black hole, and then radiation is always there, and it will actually be a larger contributor maybe further out. But I think it's simplistic when we talk about winds, and we realized that for a single quasar, we measure multiple components of winds. Like in some quasars, we have the winds we see in X-rays. The velocities differ significantly from the UV winds, from the extended winds, from oxygen 3 and molecular winds. So we have to be careful when we're talking about one wind in one, anyway.
So back to the inclination issue. I worry that, 80 degree inclinations, basically the accretion disk, especially the inner regions giving you the X-rays, will be self-eclipsing. I mean, forget tori and anything else. I mean, just the thickness of the disk, you're into that thickness in your viewing angle. So that may signal a possible way out of this, which is that if you're high inclination but not that extreme, then firstly you have to do your ray tracing not down to the mid-plane but down to some other surface that may give you, that may actually give you slightly bigger blue shifts than the razor thin case. And then the other way out that alleviates things a little bit is if the disk is ionized. It doesn't have to be 6.4 kV. Mm-hmm. It can be 6.9 kV.
Yeah. And so as I showed, the unlensed spectra indicate that it's actually not ionized. That's at 6.4.
Well, but you're picking out the very central parts of the disk with the lens, whereas your unlensed spectrum is a much more global spectrum. Yeah. So you're not picking out the same region. So I think that could be a possible way, not out of high inclinations, but alleviating the extreme
value of the inclination.
So you have a lot of multi-wavelength data. Mm-hmm. What does your spectral energy distribution look like?
We haven't actually used it, in this particular project that much, because we're not using this to calculate, let's say, wind driving. Mm-hmm. So we haven't really, compiled the SEDs for the sample. I mean, since we have the data, it might be useful. Actually, one of these objects, the Einstein cross, we did see in one of the observations out of many a P-Cygni profile of a wind. So it might be interesting for that object to actually, which would be interesting because since it's almost face on, to see a wind from that object might be exciting. So, sorry? No, this is in the X-ray, so it's the iron 25 or 26, highly ionized iron that typically seen. But we actually see a P-Cygni profile forming, so it's likely a wind.
So your two high inclination ones, do they have bowels, UV bowels?
That's a good question. No, I don't. I don't think so. RXC-1131, I don't think they have, I agree that there, there are issues regarding having something that highly inclined. That's, I think, some of the things we're trying is improving our simulations to see if additional effects will change that inclination angle. It's very hard to get something to be, blue shifted to such high energies without any other mechanism. Obviously, you have, the two things competing, the gravitational redshift and the special relativistic effect, and in the end, GR wins. When you get very close to the black hole, everything gets redshifted.
Is there any way you could tell whether the disk is tilted in the very inner part?
I haven't thought about that. So if you can see a change in...
Just don't know what the implications are for your G-min and G-max.
I haven't thought about that. That's a good question to see if we can...
Yeah, I was just going to point out there could be more than one inclination angle. The very inner disk could be tilted relative to the outer torus. But what are the prospects for measuring a distribution of these inclination angles with future microlensing surveys? Because a high inclination like these will boost your X-ray signal, but if you have a much larger sample and you still find they're all high inclination, then I would worry.
Yeah. So the prospects, I just had one slide, is coming up is LSST. So what we're limited to now is the fact there are only a few lenses we can do this technique on, but the estimates of are that we should get about 4,000 new lenses with LSST, and hopefully Chandra or an upcoming X-ray mission will have the spatial resolution to allow us to do this. And so this will allow us then to do a systematic study of, you know, spin parameters as a function of redshift, and also more than just that, but sizes of disks as a function of redshift. And
okay, it's maybe a perfect note to wrap up the morning session. Thank you very much again.
Thanks.